It's the idea that you can be traumatized by an event or a series of events, even though you didn't actually witness them firsthand.
Welcome to the Journalism Explainer, a new podcast series that tells the backstories of journalism's reinvention. I'm Asha Phillips in Singapore, and I'm collaborating on this series with Fairfax Media's Head of Editorial Capability, Julie Pacetti, who's in Sydney. In this episode, we're tackling the emerging problem of vicarious trauma in newsrooms. Sam Doubley is the co-founder and director of Eyewitness Media Hub, a UK not-for-profit think tank that studies the impact of user-generated content, otherwise known as UGC or Eyewitness Media, on the news industry. In December last year, Eyewitness Media Hub released a report which showed that 52% of journalists are engaging with disturbing eyewitness media at least several times a week. And I spoke to Sam from his home in Istanbul.
We're seeing an increase in vicarious trauma or a risk of vicarious trauma for journalists who are working in their newsroom but are watching a huge amount of content of traumatic events on their desktop, on their computer screen. Because they're sourcing content, videos, photographs, audio from social media. So we set out to look at the impact that this was having in newsrooms because it's not been very explored so far. As the technologies have advanced and sprinted ahead, we as journalists always try and catch up, but don't really think or don't have the time to think about the impact that this has on journalists working with this content. So we tried to have a look at the impact of vicarious trauma amongst journalists working in newsrooms in their home bases, as opposed to those who actually go out into the field and cover events firsthand.
Okay, great. So who was involved in the research project and what sort of journalists were you speaking to, if you can say?
Sure. I mean, the research was done under confidentiality, so I can't speak about the organizations we spoke to, nor give you names of people we actually spoke to. But suffice it to say, we spoke to some of the biggest news organizations in the world, and we spoke to a range of people who've worked at different levels of experience in those organizations. So we spoke to senior editors, directors, as well as first year, second year journalists just out of journalism school, to get an understanding of the broad spectrum of impact on different individuals.
And what did you find through the research?
So, we only spoke to journalists or asked journalists to fill in the survey who work with UGC on a day-to-day basis. So those who didn't work with UGC were excluded purposefully from the research. So in a way, we can't actually say that this is something that impacts all journalists, but we can say that this is something that impacts journalists working with content sourced from social media. And of those journalists who are using social media on a day-to-day basis, a lot of them, i.e. 52% of the journalists who responded to our survey, view distressing eyewitness media several times a week. So that means that over half these people are really looking at some of the most horrific things. And the range of things they look at is what makes it very interesting. They can be looking at really traumatic content from Syria in 1 hour. And then if there's a natural disaster, say the earthquake in Nepal or a typhoon in the Philippines or whatever, they can look at different horrific events on the same day, in the same week, and then they have no way of actually compartmentalizing and dealing with this content. So the amount of content they're seeing is really what makes the impact of social media a danger for journalists then having to deal with the problems of vicarious trauma, which then can lead to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Which is obviously, it's such a different beast to, dealing with, if you're a foreign correspondent, when a typhoon happens, you go into those cities, into those villages, and you do your reporting, and then you come out. And then if you need to, you've got services like counselling, you've got time to unwind. So you can really kind of separate yourself, I guess, after you've experienced that. Whereas these journalists sitting in their own newsrooms or at home, are going from Syria to a typhoon to a whatever other disaster.
Exactly. And the difference is, of course, you know, we've been sending, the industry has been sending correspondents out into the field since time immemorial. And we've actually, the industry has actually got to a place where we are aware of the risk to correspondents, to producers we're sending into the field. So, you know, we have hostile environments training, we have debriefings when people come back from mission, and so on and so forth. It's an accepted thing to talk about. It's an accepted thing to deal with. With vicarious trauma, because the use of social media is so relatively new, our organizations are not set up in a way to understand and to deal with the impact of looking at deeply distressing content, you know, as in 52% of journalists several times a week. So number one, there's a stigma still attached to talking about this stuff, to talking about the fact that, you know, I as an individual have looked at, you know, the aftermath of 10 barrel bombs in Syria this week, and I feel really, really bad about it. If you come back from the field and you've seen, you know, the aftermath of a barrel bomb, it's quite normal and quite understandable that you want to talk about this, that you want to have counseling about it. For junior, in particular, journalists who are, you know, quite frequently, it's junior journalists who become social media producers, you know, fresh out of journalism school, you understand YouTube, you understand Twitter, you understand Snapchat, will put you on the social media desk. Those people don't, number one, you know, they don't feel in a position where they can talk up to their senior management about the distress of seeing so much violence and so much horror and so much sadness. So the organizations really need to be set up in a better way to deal with the impact of looking at social media content. And this was a challenge that news organizations dealt with in the 80s and the 70s with people going into the field. And that's when hostile environments training was first devised. And at that point, it was a challenge. So what one of the things that really comes out of the research is this idea that news organizations need to set themselves up to deal with, to help social media producers in the same way as they help field producers or correspondents.
And I guess it's been about 5 or 6 years now since, you know, UGC has been a part of a news gathering process. So what sort of changes have you seen, or have the journalists that you spoke to seen, in the way that they're dealing with the potential, you know, trauma from seeing this imagery, and their newsrooms or their managers are dealing with it? Have you seen a change, or does more need to be done?
I mean, I think we did some research in 2013, 2014 about social media use in broadcast newsrooms in general. And we asked senior editors and journalists about vicarious trauma at that time, just one question. And at that time, senior managers were kind of were saying, oh, you know, I was in Bosnia in the 90s. This is nothing different, or there's no way this is bad as actually being on the ground. You know, people shouldn't really be talking about vicarious trauma. People shouldn't be talking about problems of viewing distressing imagery. They should just get on with their jobs. Now, that was in 2013, 2014. This research we carried out at the back end of 2015, and already there was a shift. There was an acknowledgement by managers that due to the sheer volume and speed of the requirement of using social media for news gathering, vicarious trauma, or mitigating vicarious trauma, more importantly, had really become an issue for them. Now, one of the problems we identified, though, is, I mean, it's good that people are realizing it's an issue. One of the issues that comes with that, though, is organizations aren't quite there yet in understanding what to do about it. They're trying various things. They say they have counselors at hand, but I think there's a problem with saying, okay, there's a phone number that a journalist can call and speak to a counselor, because what you're doing there is kind of treating people when they get sick, and news organizations really need to be in a situation of preventing the sickness happening in the first place. So if news organizations then could build resilience programs or ongoing systems whereby, number one, people feel they're able to say, you know, I've been working on the Syria desk or the Gaza desk or the earthquake desk for the past week, I need to work on something a bit lighter, And there's no stigma attached to doing that. One of the things that came out of the research, especially amongst junior journalists, was they felt worried about saying that they were having a problem because they were scared of them being taken off the hard international news desk, which is where they wanted to be, and then kind of put onto something, you know, entertainment or sport, that wasn't where they actually wanted to work. So people are working through feeling distressed because they're scared it will have an impact on their career. So number one, news organizations need to be set up in a way that prevents people being traumatized. And number two, there needs to be a culture within the organization that journalists can speak up safely without feeling that it will have a problem, have a negative impact on their career.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, you know, as journalists, you know, whether you go through this in training or whether you learn it on the job, which is more likely, is that, you know, you kind of get taught that you're not meant to have feelings about the news that you're reporting. You're just giving the facts, giving context. So I think for, you know, journalists, it's often hard for them to admit that, you know, yes, they might be disturbed by something, but does it go to that next level of them being traumatized? And so in that sense, it is a top-down approach, right? It is the management needing to tell them, educate their teams that it's okay to talk about that.
Absolutely. And I think there's another place where it comes in, which, you know, increasingly the industry is hiring journalists who have been through journalism school generally now, which wasn't the case, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago when I was starting out. But now it's kind of, it's a prerequisite to have a master's in journalism pretty much. But while journalism schools are now teaching, you know, how to news gather through using social media, TweetDeck, YouTube, whatever, they don't talk about the risk of trauma. And I think it's also a module that needs to be introduced at journalism schools so that people have the awareness and the knowledge when they're starting out in their jobs of what they may face.
Yeah, I remember reading from your research that a lot of people that you were speaking to were saying, I just didn't expect to be seeing this kind of content, even though I knew my job was to source content from Facebook or Twitter, etc. I just didn't expect that I would see, you know, dead bodies, blood, children injured, etc., etc. So people just, you know, they knew they might see something slightly disturbing, but they just didn't realize the full extent of what they might be asked to do.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really an issue of volume. You know, it's just all out there now. It's all just a click away, right? With just two or three tips, you can find all this stuff so easily. And it's, you know, it's almost harder to avoid than it is to find.
Yeah. I think it's more difficult now to avoid than ever.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, 10 years ago when I was working in a newsroom, you know, during the Iraq war, the invasion of Iraq, you know, I was working in a newsroom based in Geneva in Switzerland, and you'd get kind of the daily feed, you know, or hourly feed even of rushes from the news agencies, from Reuters, from AP. And you'd see those coming to your newsroom unfiltered, but in a way they'd already been shot by a cameraman or camerawoman who, you know, was, if you like, editing as they were shooting. You know, they'd realized you wouldn't need to see all that gore to tell the story because they'd been professionally trained. Mm-hmm. Now, and it'd just be one angle, and they'd get there, you know, 5-10 minutes after the bomb had exploded in Baghdad, for instance. Now it's, you know, 10 cameras, 15 cameras on the same thing, same event, same explosion as it happens.
Live.
And all over, and all uploaded to YouTube or to whatever site they use to host the video. So the pure volume, and you know, we see that in the research with another editor we spoke to who was based in Jerusalem during the Second Intifada, and they said, you know, it's worse now because you just didn't, you know, he was in Jerusalem during the Second Intifada, he was seeing all the, you know, horror firsthand. But it wouldn't be as frequent as gathering through social media. So that volume and availability has really changed the game, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember, you know, when I started working at Storyful about almost 6 years ago, I guess, at the early days, it was really difficult to actually do my job, to go and find that content Whereas I think now, I mean, I'm not doing that job anymore, and I still see that sort of content come through in my Twitter feed, and I'm not looking for it.
Well, speaking of Storyful, I think it's important that I give you a bit of background information on why I wanted to do my first podcast on vicarious trauma. And it's really because I have firsthand experience in that. And I was involved in the research project with Sam and Eyewitness Media Hub, and I was speaking about my experience at Storyful. So I was the Asia editor of Storyful, as I mentioned, about 6 years back, and I was the first international hire outside of Dublin, where it was headquartered, and we had a couple of people in the US. And I was living in Vietnam, working from home on my own, and besides like 1 or 2 hours each day where I had a crossover with my colleagues in the morning or the evening, I was working alone. And that was at the beginning of the Arab Spring and the Syrian conflict. So I found myself for 4 to 6 hours a day looking at really graphic content. And my job at Storyful was to source content and verify it from eyewitnesses who posted that content on social media. So this was the very early days of anyone looking at social media for content. So there wasn't really a playbook either on how to deal with this sort of traumatic content. And I found myself looking at a lot of it out of Syria. Eventually, I took myself off that particular story, and I just couldn't handle it anymore. What I found the most impactful was actually not just what I saw, but what I was hearing in the videos that I was looking at. And I found that was the most traumatic, actually. And Sam, I just wanted to ask you, you know, what is it that got you involved in Eyewitness Media Hub and interested in doing the research project on vicarious trauma?
I was working in newsrooms in 2002, 2003, during the second invasion of Iraq. And after victory, in inverted commas, all the bombs and assassinations and murders were happening around Baghdad and around the country. And at that time, there was also several beheadings. And I was the one in our newsroom, age 26, who kind of said, it's okay, guys. It's okay, team. I'll look at these for you. I'll make sure, you know, they're okay. And to this day, I wish I hadn't. You know, I don't know why I did it. You know, was it being male bravado? Was it, you know, trying to get myself up the career ladder by saying I can do this, whatever. And I really wish I hadn't to this day. You know, every time, even just seeing the, you know, picture of Jim Foley in an orange jumpsuit 2 years ago was enough to bring back the memories of that, of looking at those videos. So at that time, I was quite impacted by it. I wouldn't say I got vicarious trauma, but I was deeply distressed by looking at those videos. And then I became head of a newsroom in 2010 as the Arab Spring was happening. And I saw my team looking at, you know, like at Storyful, and we were a Storyful client, looking at all these videos coming in from Libya, from Egypt, from Syria, and not really knowing what to do for my team to help them with all the video that they had to look at. Because not for one second am I saying we shouldn't be looking at this stuff as journalists. I think it's our job to look at this content as journalists. But I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know how it was impacting them, and there were no resources available. So when we set up Eyewitness Media Hub in 2014, it was an area that kind of was quite obvious to me for us to explore more.
The DART Centre is a project of Columbia Graduate School of Journalism in New York. We're an organisation predominantly by journalists and for journalists.
That's Kate McMahon, the Managing Director of the DART Centre for Trauma in Asia Pacific. We spoke just a day after she returned to Australia from Nepal, where she was training journalists almost a year after the devastating earthquake there.
And that was a training of trainers. So those journalists, those 23 journalists that we just trained in collaboration with the IFJ and the FNJ in Nepal, they will now go back into the regions and train their own journalists, their colleagues, about trauma awareness and trauma-sensitive journalism, and also about self-care principles in the face of doing this sort of reporting.
We'll come back to Nepal and also some of the self-help stuff in a minute. But first, I just want to ask you a little bit about the cultural differences with dealing with trauma, whether it be vicarious or otherwise, because you must see across Asia Pacific, which is such a diverse region, that the people deal with this in various different ways.
You know, there are different cultural ways of managing post-trauma. And as I was saying to you before, I think in many ways the collectivist cultures deal with it better in the region than those of us coming from much more individualistic cultures in the Asia-Pacific region. So the Nepalese folks were talking about how they banded together a lot after the earthquake. Now, I think that still would happen in Australia too. But the sorts of caring and concern that went on for the colleagues, I don't think would happen in the same degree in the individualistic cultures. Also, there's spiritual ways of dealing with it in terms of karma and managing suffering, I think, is very different. Having a spiritual base that they can help understand this, and also in Pakistan, I found that they had a spiritual base for understanding suffering that I don't think we have in the western parts of the ASPAC region. But, you know, it's really interesting. When I go in country and do training and I always put to journalists, you know, is there a word for what we know in the West as trauma? What words, what phrases do you put around this? And whether it's the training I've done in Pakistan or Cambodia or Taiwan or Japan, they all have different words and phrases. Like, you know, in Vietnamese, it's called loss of heart, losing, or loss of spirit. I've lost my heart, I've lost my spirit. So whilst they'll have different sorts of contexts and phrases that are steeped in different spiritualities and cultural beliefs, ultimately when it comes down to it, every culture where I've talked about it, the physiological reactions and the types of expressions are exactly the same, which has really shocked me, actually, because when I've done cross-cultural reading about this, I've read that in Asia they tend to feel trauma in the body more, that sort of thing. But ultimately I've found that whilst that might be true, there's still the same expressions of crying, of despair, of wailing, of, you know, feeling low mood. These sorts of things come out regardless of where I am across the region, which is really interesting.
Let's just come back to the self-help aspect of dealing with trauma that you mentioned before. Now, I've experienced this myself after looking at traumatic imagery or hearing traumatic content from the web. And research that Dart Center and Eyewitness Media Hub did also recommends that the self-care aspect of dealing with it is extremely important. So I want to just ask you, when you go into newsrooms, what do you teach journalists about how they can help themselves either prevent trauma or deal with it after it's happened?
All animals, if you like, to put it to that basic level, react to threat and horror in the same sort of way. Beating heart, pupils dilating, fight-flight response. We're programmed to respond in that way. And so a big part of what I do is trying to explain that to journalists and destigmatise impact, potential impact or reactions that people have by saying, look, this is normal, folks. We should respond to horror in this way. But look, we do know that limiting your dose to exposure is a really important thing to do. And I think you're right. I think there has been an explosion, certainly in the digital space, of this vicarious trauma exposure, where journalists are not necessarily working in the field but are having this sort of second-hand experience of exposure, which is what we would call vicarious trauma. And, you know, there are definitely things that you can do. So certainly limiting your dose to that sorts of terror, rage, despair. So what I would suggest if you're at a screen and are experiencing this, that you put in times for very regular breaks to the exposure to the content. You might want to change the resolution on your screen. if you can, putting it in black and white or putting a matte sort of a finish on the screen. Certainly limiting sounds. Very often when I've spoken to journalists who are sitting in front of a screen and looking at graphic content, they say it's not so much the visual imagery, but it's the screams and the sounds that they're hearing. So what I would suggest is getting what you need for the story, or getting what you need to write your story, and then turning it down or limiting it as much as you can. Make sure you get peer support and social support. Talk to people who get you and understand, where you can just sort of go blah, if you like, and get this stuff off your chest. I also suggest, I'm very big on people putting really funny, dorky stuff on their own screen, or their own, whether it be an iPod or, you know, your phone, relaxation types of things on your phone, cat videos or silly things, funny things. So you can have a circuit breaker is another strategy I suggest.
Great advice there from Kate McMahon. Get some quirky, silly cat videos on screen to break up the traumatic content that you're looking at. Now, for anyone who's looking for more information on vicarious trauma, you can get in touch with Eyewitness Media Hub via Twitter at EMHub, or the Dart Center for Trauma at Dart Center, and center is spelt with an ER. And that's all that we have time for of this episode of The Journalism Explainer. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, or you can connect with Julie and myself on Twitter at JExplainer, or on Facebook, The Journalism Explainer. Thank you so much, and we'll be back again with another episode in a couple of weeks.